Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Good morning, Austin and Jim. Thought we'd talk a little bit this morning about some of the developments over in Israel and Iran. Ahmadinejad has been making some statements again. I don't know when he's not making statements about Israel needing to be destroyed. What is the reality of Israel actually attacking Iran before or after the elections? What is that situation as it stands now? I think we'll start out with you this morning, Austin. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll tell you what, if you'd asked me this a year ago, I would have thought that Israel had already struck by now. And it's extremely hard to make that kind of call because we don't have access to the current intelligence, and we can only estimate what Israeli capabilities are. Note, too, that there have been more reports, and I'll let Jim discuss this in more detail, that some of the cyber weapons, Stuxnet and follow-on Stuxnet, have continued to have effects on Iranian nuclear production capabilities, so that there's that attack has already occurred, and it's something we've discussed on Strategy Talk actually several times. But when I say an attack, I meant military assault using air and special forces. That hadn't occurred, Dan, and I think as the the big date is, quote-unquote, the U.S. election, the first Tuesday in November. Will Israel launch that attack before the U.S. election? And how will the U.S. respond? What will the Obama administration do? How will the U.S. Will the U.S. be involved? Will the U.S. get the okay? Whatever. So we're coming up on, and it's 2.5 months until that election. This is a gut call. I don't think it's going to happen. I know that the Iranians have been seriously pursuing a nuclear weapon. They have been for at least 15 years. Actually, it's longer than that. Early 90s, they were already spinning the program up. I read the same things you do in the open press about how much enriched uranium they have. Do they have enough for a bomb now? Recall that the Iranian, several Iranian officials, but one of them, Ahmadinejad, said, described, and Khamenei did this as well, described Israel as a one-bomb state, meaning if one nuclear weapon of sufficient size, Israel is so small that you will eliminate Israel. And as a matter of fact, there was just 3 or 4 days ago, another senior Iranian cleric made the statement that Israel was going to be eradicated. So the problem remains. Eventually, either if the dictatorship, the Iranian clerical dictatorship, isn't overthrown internally, and they've done unfortunately done a very good job of repressing the green movement, is that it will come a time when the Israelis and possibly Israelis in the United States, and you can come up with scenarios that at least the assistance, the covert assistance of other nations in the region. That's an opaque way of saying Persian Gulf Arab states. I mean, we spoke, I think, at one time about the WikiLeaks revelation, which really wasn't much of a revelation, that one of the Saudi defense ministers had said, the Israelis could overfly Saudi territory when they were attacking Iran. that's been an assumption that many folks have had that makes you an implicit, if not directly complicit, participant in the Israeli attack on the Iranians. I think it's going to happen. But given you the response to that, I don't think it's likely before November. I'd be interested to hear what Jim has to say about that, though.
Jim?
Well, on the face of it, the Iranians want to be attacked by Israel or the United States simply because the government in Iran has most of the population against it. You know, they put down the active resistance, but the passive resistance is growing daily. I mean, basically, most Iranians hate their government. But it's a very effective police state, you know, mobilizing a minority of religious fanatics who are willing to, you know, do whatever has to be done to keep the religious dictatorship in power. If a foreign country attacked Iran, the people would mobilize behind whatever, you know, government there was. I mean, that's what happened in Soviet Union in 1941. It's just the nature of the beast. It doesn't always work, as the Argentinian, you know, military dictatorship found out in 1982. But that depends on whether or not you win or lose. And since an air raid would not be an invasion, all the Iranian government has to do, you know, after the bombers are gone, or say, hey, we won. We're still here. And indeed, it's problematic if they could, you know, do enough damage to the nuclear weapons development to slow it down by a significant amount. I mean, how many years? Because the people, the knowledge, the will to create those nuclear weapons is still there. Now, the other thing, which Austin alluded to, was things we don't know about, intelligence and what have you. And it's quite possible that the Israelis have intelligence that there are enough crazy people near the top that if they do get a nuke, they got the ballistic missiles, they might try and nuke Israel. Now, the reason why Israel would not, you know, say we have this information is because their source would be in danger. You don't want to endanger a source that close to the center of things. The United States recently announced that we had people inside the Iranian nuclear program. I don't know why they made that announcement. You don't really want to say that sort of thing if you really do. But then again, maybe we don't. And but we do know a lot because of our internet-based espionage, which has slowly been revealed. It's been going on for over 5 years. But there have been, you know, like Stuxnet, as Austin mentioned earlier, Stuxnet and several other programs, which were finally came to light, internet security firms discovered them, and they announced it, and people and distribute copies of it that were well hidden. But what they also find out is some of these things have been around for 3 or 4 years. Hidden, you know, out of sight, which is the most effective form of internet espionage. And all of a sudden, there have been a lot of arrests and a lot of prosecutions of people and institutions in the West, including a lot of banks, who for years have been basically laundering money for Iran. So there's suddenly a lot of information available, and it's being used. Now, it's also known, and this was admitted, that this internet espionage effort was a combined U.S.-Israeli operation. So the Israelis are getting an enormous amount of information, and possibly some of this information they've gotten is fairly compelling information that Israel is in more danger than most people think. Again, that's a very tricky situation because no matter how vulnerable your source, and again, I'm assuming it's a human source because they wouldn't hesitate to say, you know, here's emails or whatever, although there is some danger in that because it might expose an internet espionage bit of software that has not been revealed, discovered yet. And they want to keep it, working away for a while because it's collecting such good intel. So whatever the case, the majority of Israelis, not being privy to whatever, you know, hotshot information the people running Israel have, are basically telling the opinion polls, no, we don't want to attack Iran, because obviously anybody who pays the least bit of attention to history in that area, or history in general, is that you're going to ruin the brewing revolution in Iran if you attack the place. Something else to keep in mind is that having nuclear weapons is very popular among almost all Iranians, because one thing all Iranians agree on is that they are the superpower in that part of the world. They don't think much of the Arabs or the Russians or the Turks or anybody else, because they've basically been able to hold off or defeat, you know, all of those groups for a long, long time. And they feel that they're only temporarily and in reduced circumstances. That's why they're so angry at Britain, because it was Britain that basically kept them in a cage, you know, for nearly a century. Once they get their nuclear weapons, they can once more, you know, stride forth, exercising the power they've been wielding for thousands of years. So that's something else to worry about. But the basic situation is the religious dictatorship in Iran is on a volcano, which is about ready to explode. And when it does, that's the end of the religious dictatorship. I mean, you're all well aware of what happened in 1989 and 1991, that all these dictatorships eventually come to an end, no matter how well their police state is set up. This may be why Israel believes that the religious senior clerics in Iran might have a plan that if they seem to be too close to being destroyed, they're going to basically try and nuke Israel, which actually makes sense in a perverse way, because even if it fails, even getting a nuclear weapon intercepted by the Israeli Arrows anti-missile system would, of course, spread nuclear material. You know, if they blew up the warhead, there would be nuclear material raining down on the Saudi Arabia and what have you, the Arab states, which, again, doesn't bother most Iranians. They don't like Arabs. It'll, you know, if they fall out, it's good for them. Might improve the breed. Who the hell knows? I mean, they just have this utter contempt for Arabs. But it would also send a message to the Israelis, that you may have stopped us this time, but we're building more, and we'll keep trying. So, again, this is why we don't cover speculation in the strategy page. It's really much too iffy. But this is one of the possibilities. If you're asking, well, why, or is the Israeli leadership pushing for something that on the face of it is playing into the hands of the enemy, you know, attacking, bombing Iran? That's the only conceivable thing. I mean, this reminds me of the situation I was in, you know, back in the 90s, when people were asking me, why does Saddam keep, I got hammered with this, you know, again and again on TV, why does Saddam keep, you know, playing games with the weapons of mass destruction inspectors, when all if he hasn't got any, all he has to do is open up everything, stop playing games, and then he can, you know, get these sanctions lifted, then he can go back to building them, because as I kept pointing out, he has the information, he has the experts and what have you. And as we later found out, he was doing that because he was deathly afraid that if he admitted he didn't have any, you know, stockpiles of chemical weapons or nukes or whatever, Iran would invade. So you never can tell.
Right. The great game continues.
Exactly. So, you know, the Israeli leaders are afraid of something.
Right.
And that's the most reasonable explanation. If there is a clique of Looney Tunes at the top in Iran who have basically greenlit an attempt to nuke Israel. I can't think of anything else. You know, there might be other things, but they don't come to mind.
Austin, how does the events going on in Syria, Iran's relationship with Syria and Israel, how does that all intertwine and play together?
Oh, Dan, how many days do we have to try to parse that?
Well, we have about 10 minutes, so that's about what you
let me reshape the question. I mean, the Israelis have no love lost for the Assads. They know the Assad regime is it's not a wholly owned subsidiary of the Iranian government, but it is a funded subsidiary of the Iranian government, both in terms of finances and weapons, ammunition. It's the route to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Lebanese Hezbollah is a forward base for Iranian operations against Israel. That's a strategic. That's more than that, but that's strategically that's what Lebanese Hezbollah is for Iran vis-a-vis Israel. It's also one route to Hamas. It's not the only route to Hamas. The Israelis are very concerned that a fragmentation in Syria, as everyone else is, and into you know, terrorist stands, a stand run by Al-Qaeda, the radical elements of the Muslim Brotherhood and the like, but that's also the fear of Jordan and the fear of Turkey, and really even the fear of Iraq as well. The Iraqi national government certainly doesn't want to see a Kurdistan emerge in northeastern Syria, and Turkey is dead set against it. So the power players in the Middle East, which are in that area, which are Turkey and Israel, are not going to let it happen. It may take a lot of effort to stop that from happening if and when the Assad's finally fall. Does it directly connect to the topic today, an Israeli attack on Iran to eliminate their nuclear systems? Not directly, but it certainly is part of the thicket entangled there is part of the dangerous relationship. It's part of the Iranians' strategy to undermine other states within the Middle East, but also to attack the state of Israel. But in terms of the nuclear question, here's how the nuclear question ties in to the Syria-Lebanon connection. The Israelis are concerned that the Iranians might try to slip a nuclear device into through Syria or into southern Lebanon, and then you've got the container with a nuclear weapon that's either brought to the border or it's more difficult getting inside Israel. That's a scenario that is highly unlikely, but you can see why police and intelligence are concerned about it. The nuclear weapon, the radicals say, well, we give up a little piece of southern Lebanon for the huge bomb. Unlikely, but when there's nuclear weapons, you have to pay attention to a worst case. If the Assad's fall, does it make it easier? I think it makes it more difficult, ultimately, for the Iranians to use Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, because that stops the advantage the Lebanese Hezbollah has over the other Lebanese factions. They've got the money and guns coming through Syria from Iran. Now they're just like everybody else, whether they're the Druze or the Sunnis or the Christians. They've lost their big backer. So that's something of a silver lining in the general dark threat of that coming from Iran through Syria to Lebanon for the Israelis. It's a major problem for the Israelis, Dan, because there are only certain things they can do overtly, immediately. The Assads have tried to bait the Israelis into an attack. There are a couple of major times that they had Palestinians move towards the border to try to bring the Israelis into it so that the Assads could say, look, there's the real enemy down there. It's not us. They traded on that, on hating the Israelis since the Assads came to power. But all the Arab regimes have used that card at some time or the other. So the Israelis have to keep a lower profile political profile. But I think that it is part of the problem, but it is, how does it relate to ultimately to the issue of the Iranian bomb? As I said, it's a route of a sneak attack, and that's that would still be open even if the Assads are gone.
Jim, your thoughts on that?
Syria would be, to the Iranians, the loss of Syria, it would be the first defeat of what, you know, many people would start predicting to be a chain of defeats. Ever since 2003, or 2001 actually, when we, the United States, you know, helpfully destroyed two of Iran's enemies, the Taliban, who were killing Shia rather enthusiastically in Afghanistan, and the Saddam Hussein, whom they hated for the 1980s war that killed over 500,000 people. Iran has gotten, you know, illusions of empire building. Hezbollah then, you know, had that war in 2006, which was actually a defeat, but they declared victory because they were still standing, you know, after it was all over. That's how that works in that part of the world. And, of course, Syria was always there. Loyal Syria, who became their ally because of a split in the Ba'ath Party back in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s. Syria simply did that because they needed protection from Saddam Hussein. You know, so Iran sees itself on a downward track, and that's bad for morale inside of Iran, and it's bad for the morale of the leadership in Iran. They have to show people that they can hang on to what is theirs and keep grabbing what is not theirs. And they have not been doing that of late. They expected to take over, to have much more control in Iraq than they actually have. And it was much to their dismay that they found out that Shia Arabs still hate them. They hated them enough in the 1980s to fight for Saddam Hussein. The Iraqi Shia, you know, never rose up in rebellion. Indeed, one of the reasons for the rebellion after the 91 war in Iraq of the Shia in the south was that they felt that they had not been sufficiently rewarded for their loyalty in the war with Iran. But despite all that, you know, once Iraq was, you know, free and holding elections, the majority of Iraqi Shia told Iran, says, no, you know, we don't want what you're doing. We don't want what you're having. So please stay away. So Iran basically feels that, you know, they'd come so close, and now it's all fading away. And we can only hope that they keeps on going.
Right. Now, one of the things is you mentioned earlier about Saudi Arabia and Iran. Now, Saudi Arabia has been making some demonstrations publicly that they're all happy, well, not happy with Iran, but they're trying to strengthen relations with Iran. Is that all just smoke and mirrors?
No, it's basically another form of insult. It's basically telling the Iranians that we feel you have become so weak, let's pretend we're friends again. Notice that the Saudis and all their Arab neighbors have tens of billions of dollars of weapons orders being processed as we speak. So they're arming themselves to the teeth. They're taking great joy, I hate to use that word, but there's no other one to describe it, in what's going on in Syria, because Syria is basically run by a Shia minority. And there's nothing the Sunnis like more than the Shia being taken down a notch, because Sunnis basically look at the Shia as, you know, heretics. Not only that, their chief sponsor of the Shia are Iran, which are not even Arabs. You know, again, the bad attitude flows both ways across the Gulf. The Arabs despise the Iranians, or actually they fear them, but they also despise them. And of course, the Iranians despise the Arabs. So this whole let's be friends is a classic insult in that part of the world, actually in other parts of the world as well. But they're basically telling Iranian, you guys have really lost it. So, you know, here, we're gonna force you to refuse to make friends with us. Which when you think about it, you know, it's a real backhanded way of kicking somebody while they're down.
Now, Austin, does Russia continue to try to strengthen their relationships with Iran, or what is their play in that area of the world?
Russia's in it for the money, Dan. And if something is blown up in Iran, the Russians will get just blown up by the Israelis. Here, let me give you a scenario. The Israeli attack on, let's say, the reactor at Bushehr, Russians will accuse the Israelis of warmongering, aggression, and imperialism, or various equivalents, and then turn around and try to sell the Iranians another nuclear reactor. Putin has tied himself to the survival of authoritarian regimes because and we've discussed this. This is a line of analysis. I think there's some degree of truth to it, is that he's concerned about his own control in Russia. And when Arab Spring breaks out and other dictators topple, he doesn't want the Russians getting any ideas about taking on the strongman. Now, he's far more secure, at least as far as we can tell, than in my estimation, than the Iranian clerical dictatorship or the Assads. But that's still not the way the dictator sees it. He just sees the sword of Damocles over his head, and instead of having it hang by a horsehair, he wants to make sure it's hung by from a chain, or a steel cord. And the way you do that is by being tough at home, but also showing your own people that, you know, revolts don't work. So there's that component. I think that component is at play. Russia doesn't have very many real overt options for supporting the Assad regime. In terms of, you know, there have been a couple of people I have heard on radio programs say, well, what if the Russians send troops? Because there was a flurry, if you recall, there was a small Russian Marine detachment with a ship that docked at the Syrian port of Latakia a few months earlier this year. Just a Russian Marine detachment, naval infantry detachment, but they don't have the Russia doesn't have the power, and Putin isn't stupid enough to try to prop them up. Again, Syria was a Soviet client state. It remains something of a Soviet of a Russian consumer of Russian weapons and ammunition and industrial goods. So, but that's the limit of Russia's ability is to affect what goes on in Syria is by providing supplies and providing a veto in the United Nations. That's some of that is playing out is running out the ability to effectively block international action. You can block it through the UN, but notice that NATO and through Turkey and Gulf Arab states are already found other ways around the UN to support Syrian rebel groups, like the Free Syrian Army. Russia can provide the same kind of political aid international through the UN to Iran. Russia can provide smuggling routes to keep the Iranian government elites supplied with prohibited goods, goods that are prohibited by international sanctions regimen. But ultimately, if it comes to action against the Iranians, the Russians are going to sit tight.
Yeah. Jim, I am struck, as I'm always struck, with what we sort of have as our theme here at Strategy Page, which is what is happening in Iran today is no different than what's been happening in Iran for decades, which is no different than what's been happening for centuries, which is, in truth, which is no different than what has been happening for millennia when we go back and look at, what we call Iran today, 4,000 years, maybe 6,000 years ago.
Yes. And one thing to remember when you do look at it like that, you know, it's the old what goes around comes around. I mean, that phrase has been in usage for a long time and obviously for good reason. But the big reason for Iran's sometimes bad situations is the fact that they often fall into internal bickering. Civil war, for want of a better word. Indeed, that's the only reason the Arabs were able to defeat them in the 7th century, you know, when Islam got started and the first Muslims decided that, you know, peaceful conversions were not really working too well, so let's try the sword, and that worked splendidly. And they found that the Iranians were in the midst of a rather nasty civil war, and they said, well, let's invade Iran, which in any earlier time, Arabs would have thought it was insanity, but hey, you know, the religious fervor was there, and it worked. Now, the Arabs were soon, you know, squeezed out, very politely, and Iran stayed Islamic, but to this day, you still have this, this factionalism inside Iran, and that's something that tends to be forgotten. Again, if you're going to use the lessons from history, you got to pay attention to all of them, because there's a lot of ones. Usually, we only pay attention to the ones that are active at the moment or in the news. But as we point out in Strategy Page, well, here's the other ones that are waiting there to go boom, and that factionalism is one of them. Now, some people had picked up with the Arab Spring, you know, all this energetic search for freedom and democracy and what have you. But again, as we've been explaining for over 10 years now, you have factionalism, tribalism, whatever, in all these countries, which is not easy to overcome. And again, with the internet, there's a lot of more history out there at people's fingertips. Go look at the history of Europe. We should have Alan Opie here to be able to cite his specific web pages. But anyway, Europe went through the same process of going from, you know, tribalism, and there's still a little tribalism left in Europe, but, you know, two or three centuries ago, there was a lot more of it. You know, Britain had their last major battles in the 18th century against, you know, Scottish tribal coalitions. And it is done, it can be done, and one thing, for example, the special forces, they study this stuff a lot, because they have to go into countries that are still, you know, being torn apart by tribal warfare and animosities, Afghanistan, Iraq, and they are quite familiar, you know, with what it takes to modernize. Basically, you modernize a culture, a society, out of the need for tribalism, because the only reason tribalism survives is because there's no other effective form of government people can depend upon for anything. And this is why you have tribalism. And people are not all that eager to go jumping from tribalism to something they've never tried before, because, you know, life is pretty grim, you know, with a tribal government, and they know it can be a lot worse without any government at all, which you can see in Somalia and in parts of Afghanistan and other parts of the world. But these are the lessons of history, which, as you point out, are still valid. People should pay more attention to them.
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll wrap it up there, gentlemen, and we'll talk to you next time.
Good. Thank you, Dan.
Bye.